Hi, I'm Brett Johnson, former United States Most Wanted cyber criminal, now good guy, host of The Brett Johnson Show. Yeah, that's me. Guess what? This is episode number 92, speaking the death of my father. And usually at this point, I say when we come back and we got a nice little graphic, either of the show title or the Brett Johnson Show graphic with that nice little anglerfish behind me and everything like that. But today is a bit of a different show. I'm not sure that this show is going to appeal to anyone, but I owe it to myself. I certainly owe it to my father to do this show. Before we get started, let me explain the title. The title, Speaking the Death of My Father. I'm a fan of Orson Scott Card, novelist. He wrote a book, a series of books about Ender. Ender's Game is the first. They made a movie from it. The movie sucks. Don't watch the movie. Read the books. At least the first three, they are outstanding. Anyway, one of the characters in the book, he talks about when someone passes away, when someone dies, that you should speak the death of that person, meaning not only the good things. You know, I've been to several funerals in my life, and a lot of the times the preacher is all about only talking about the good stuff, trying to preach the guy or the woman into heaven. And I've even been to funerals where there was nothing good to say about the person at all. And the preacher was like, just fine. Then heads for the door. I think if you're going to talk about the life and death of someone, that you should be truthful in everything. I guess it's because of where I've been and what I'm doing right now. I believe everyone has a story. And I made the comment the other day on social media that there is no such thing. There is no good man. There is no bad man. There's only a man, a person. And this person is capable of doing good and evil. And the only thing that matters at the end of the day is, does the good outweigh the bad? So I believe in stories, and I believe that my dad asked me a decade ago when I got out of prison. I was living with a man, and he asked me, he's like, son, when I die, I want you to write my epitaph and speak at my funeral. And I told him I would. Well, my dad did not want a service. So the only avenue I have to do that is this show. So this show may not appeal to you. For that, I do not apologize. There is a fast forward button. There's a skip button as well. If you don't listen to it, you don't have to. But this is something that I'm doing for me, so I can help work through things, and for my father, because I told him that I would. For those who don't know, my dad passed away October 2nd, just a couple of weeks ago. He passed away. He had his wife, Patricia Johnson. Patricia Brock was her maiden. I don't know if it's her maiden name. That was her name before she met my dad. She passed away February of 2022. July of 2022 was the last time my dad ever walked. He's got this thing called Charcot's foot. So he's a type 2 diabetic. And Charcot's foot is also, it's one of these things where the bones in the ankle start to collapse. And they were doing that. He was wearing like the Forrest Gump legs. He was wearing that in order to walk, and he'd gotten to the point where he couldn't even really walk. He was just more or less shuffling, like Tim Conway used to on the Carol Burnett Show. I mean, it was just a pitiful sight to see. Well, his wife passes away February of last year, and July he'd gotten to the point where he would just leave the house. He was down in Panama City, Florida. I'm in Birmingham, Alabama. He would leave the house once a day to go and have lunch and then come back. And that was his routine. That was his daily life. The only other time he would leave the house was when he had a doctor's appointment. And he had a lot of doctor's appointments. This is a man who not only had Charcot's foot, He was in kidney failure. He had a congestive heart failure. His shoulder, he had absolutely no ability to use his right arm because his shoulder needed replacing. He was a host of comorbidities that were going to take him out. I go down to visit him. What had happened was he goes out to lunch. He comes back, and as he's walking in the door, even though he had those splints that were helping, you know, keep his legs okay and everything, his right leg, his right ankle collapsed at that point, and he broke it. He didn't know. He went to the emergency room, and the doctor said, "Oh, it's not broken." Now, the doctor says this as the foot is literally turned at a 90-degree angle to the rest of the leg. So my dad was in the emergency room for a few hours. They sent him back. I go down to visit him. Me and my wife, Michelle, we go down to visit him. And it was obvious that he was done living with himself. And we had a talk at that point. And he asked me, he told me, "I no longer have the ability to make these decisions for myself. Will you do this for me? Will you handle things from here on out?" And I think the man knew at that point in time what he was asking me. I absolutely knew what he was asking me. And I said yes. I said yes, knowing that at the end of the day, that I would be the bad guy. But I took on that responsibility because my father simply could not. Even if he was the man he used to be, he was always scared of dying. And he was a man that was not very good sometimes about making choices. About, you know, he would just kind of veer back and forth between choices instead of committing to something. And something like that, when it's obvious that things are going downhill, he just wanted me to make that, and I told him I would. And later on, a few days before the man, passed away, I had a really good talk with him, and I told him, I was like, "Dad, I knew when I told you I'd take care of you and see this out, I knew that it was going to end up with me being the bad guy. And I knew that when you asked me." And he looks at me and he's like, "Son, yeah, but you've got the shoulders to do it." And I told him that I did. But my dad, we go down to check on him back July of last year. We go back to check on him, and it's obvious. He asked me the question. I said, "I'll take care of him." And I said, "Well, here's the first thing. You're done living in Florida. You're coming up to Birmingham, Alabama with us." And he was like, that's absolutely fine. If you think that's what I need to do, let's do that." And I was like, "Yes, Dad, I'm going to go back home. I got to get some stuff ready. And then we'll be back in 3 or 4 days to get you, take you up to Birmingham, take care of you." He was like, "That's fine." So we went back to Birmingham, came back about 3 days later, and I was loading up everything. I'd rented a truck, everything else. And I was loading up, you know, every single thing that he needed to move to Birmingham. And he was in his office. Now, this is a man that for the past several years, he had slept in his office. He had a big ass recliner, and he had slept in his office. And that was basically it. He spent, you know, 20 some hours a day in his office, other than going to doctor's appointments or out once a day to eat. So as I was loading everything up, he's in his office, just kind of fiddling around. And finally, my wife, Michelle, comes out and says, "Hey, he's not right. Something's wrong with him." So I go in, and it's obvious that something is wrong. He's not of his right mind. He's not able to move. He's repeating the same action, you know, 8, 10, 12 times, things like that. So I ask him, what's wrong? And he says, "I don't know." So I call his doctor. His doctor says, "Call 911. So I call 911. They come get him, take him to the hospital. Turns out he had sepsis, had some other really fucked up blood infection. His leg, even though the ER doctor had said it wasn't broken, they did not do an x-ray. They do an x-ray on this one, and he's got a broken leg as well. And that was the last time, a few days prior to that, was the last time my dad ever walked. So he ends up spending, I don't know, a month and a half in the hospital and in a rehab center, recovery center, so he can get better. And then at that point, he moves to Birmingham with us. He gets to Birmingham with us sometime in November. Actually, matter of fact, he gets to Birmingham with us November 8th of last year. So moves in with us. And I had told him I wanted him to come to Birmingham because I really thought that his life would be better, that he would have and I told him this, that you'll have family around you, you can interact, you won't be stuck in this house just by yourself all the time. You'll be okay, you'll get better. And I believed that, I did. But that's not the way things worked out. In our house here, we've got a split level, it's an older home, it's split level. I had two stair lifts installed because the man could not walk and he would have to ride up and down and catch a wheelchair wherever he was going. So I had two stair lifts installed in the home so he could navigate. Bought this special narrow wheelchair because an older home like this is absolutely not ADL friendly, and the doorways were very narrow and a common wheelchair won't fit through them. So I bought this very specialized wheelchair for him, everything else, set up a bedroom with a bed that would elevate and everything else for him like that, a big TV, all that. He gets in the house and the man never left the bedroom except to go on doctor's appointments. That was it. And he was months like that. He would just lay in the bed for, 22 hours a day, take his meals laying down, things like that. Get up and use the restroom. And that was it. Get up, go to the doctor's appointment. That was it. It was months. And I talked to the man probably 50 times. And not just say, just conversations. Hey, you need to, and we had physical therapy coming, things like that. Dad, you need to do the exercises. You're going to get to the point where you're not able to transfer yourself from the bed to the wheelchair or to the bathroom. And at that point, I can't take care of you. And that's pretty much what happened. Well, that's what was happening. Starting July this year, from November until July, he had been in and out of the hospital a couple of times with infections, sepsis. They had planned on doing, or they had talked about, now he was 76. They had talked about doing a below the knee amputation and a complete shoulder replacement for a man at 76. And I was calling bullshit on that. I was like, that is never going to happen. He can't survive it. So starting in July was the last time he was ever in my home. He got a blood infection, sepsis with, staph is what he got. He got sepsis with staph, a UTI, stuff like that. Goes to the VA hospital, and from July until the man passed away, it was literally he'd either be in the hospital or he'd be sent to recovery, rehab, so he could start building his strength up. And before he could be discharged from rehab, he would get another blood infection, another sepsis infection, and go back to the hospital. And it was this cycle that was going on from July until October 2nd when the man passed away. And the way the man passed away, he got to the point, he told me during the last long stint he had in the hospital that he no longer had the strength to get himself out of bed. And at that point I was like, Dad, I don't know what to do. I can't take care of you at the house. So we're going to look at getting you into a VA home, a nursing home. And yes, here's the fucking thing. I know what nursing homes are. Nursing homes are places that people go to die. I know that. Yes, some nursing homes are nicer than others, but that's like putting a perfume on a pig. It's all the same. People are going there to die. So, I knew that, but I didn't have any other choice. So we started to get him into the process of getting him into a VA home. So that way he wasn't out of pocket with anything. In the state of Alabama, some people you can denigrate Alabama as much as you fucking want. But guess what? For their veterans, they take care of them. a veterans home, a veterans nursing home, you pay a maximum of like $30 a month to live in a VA home, and they take care of you. All right. So it's really good for veterans. And my dad wanted to do that. Well, what happens is they transport him from the rehab center here in Birmingham to a kind of a transitory rehab/nursing home that the VA was paying for in Gadsden, Alabama, hour away. So I go to visit, and he had been going through what was called hospital-acquired delirium, and it was horrible. He thought, I had no idea such a thing existed, but what happens is the hospital environment can cause cognizant people that don't suffer from dementia, that aren't in Alzheimer's, that are completely clear-headed, it can cause delirium to occur. So this man was seeing things. He was convinced that the VA was trying to kill him. The only person he trusted was me. And he would call me at all hours of the night. Please help me. And I would get my ass out of bed and drive my ass to the hospital to simply go in and tell him that he was okay. So he was going through it. He'd gotten to the point where he was already on a catheter, and that was a full-time catheter. He got to the point where, since he could not get out of the bed to use the bathroom, that he was in diapers, and they had to clean the man every time he used the bathroom. So there was even a point they asked me, "Hey, will you take me out?" And as I told him at that point, that time had already passed. So they move him to Gadsden, and about the only thing the man could do was play on his phones. He had like 6 phones. He could play on his phones, and he could eat. And he was one hell of an eater. He would send me lists of shit to bring him to munch on. And by this point in time, I mean, we'd already had the talk, and I was like, "Dad, I honestly think, you know, that you've got less than a year. We're going to make the best of it." So he would send me lists of like sweet tarts, you know, bullshit like that. Type 2 diabetic. I don't give a fuck. I don't. If you're checking out, I don't care. Let the people have whatever the hell they want. You want to smoke? Fine. You want candy? Fine. You want to shoot up cocaine, crack, meth, heroin? I don't give a shit. If it makes you happy as you're going out, do it. So I was bringing him treats. He was living off of a Canada Dry ginger ale, zero. And I guess that was his healthy habit. And the rest of it was potato chips and M&Ms and sweet tarts, gummy bears, and stuff like that. So I went to visit him, and that's when we had that talk. His stepdaughter had written a letter, and we had sold my dad's house prior, but my dad's stepdaughter had written a letter. And the gist of the letter was, it started out, "I heard your dad got sick again. I heard he was going to a nursing home. Where the fuck's the money?" It was basically the gist of the letter. And so I went in that day, and I didn't know if my dad was clear-headed or not. He was that day. And I told him, I was like, "Hey, your stepdaughter's a piece of shit." And he was like, "What do you mean?" So I showed him the letter, and he was... because I don't believe in hiding things. People need to be informed. People need to know what's going on. So I showed him the letter, and he was, the only thing the man said was that it was unfortunate that she turned out that way. And I was like, "Yes, Dad, it is. And, you know, your own daughter as well. While she's not interested in money, she's not visited you or done much of anything." And You could tell the man was upset by that. So we talked, and we had that talk about me being the bad guy at the end of the day. And he looks at me, and he says, "I'm going to miss you." And I looked at him, and I said, "Dad, I'm going to miss you too." And I got up, and I went home, and as I was walking out, he's like, "Hey, son, when you come back, why don't you bring me a catfish dinner?" And I was like, "Dad, I'll be back Wednesday or Thursday, and I will bring your ass a catfish dinner." And I went home, back an hour to Birmingham. And I did not get back Wednesday or Thursday because I had... Sometimes it's unfortunate that I'm not a criminal anymore. Criminals, sometimes you can set your own hours. And where I am on the good guy side, I can't set my own hours. I got to work. I got to do shit. And I was doing shit. I didn't make it back until Friday. And this would have been the 30th of September. So I waited until later that afternoon because I wanted the restaurant that sold the really good catfish didn't open until 4. So I wanted to wait until it opened. That way I timed everything right, got him his dinner. And started to try to call him at a little after 3 p.m. on Friday. No answer. I didn't think anything about it. Tried again before I left Birmingham. No answer. My wife, Michelle, went with me. So on the way to Gadsden, I try a couple more times. No answer. I run by, get his catfish dinner, get his sweet tarts, gummy bears, potato chips, and ginger ale. And even while I'm in the grocery store, I'm trying to call his number, and there's no answer. By this point in time, I'm worried. So load up everything, go to this facility, walk in. And as I said, it's my view of nursing homes. It's a place where people go to die. You walk by the doorways, or I walk by the doorways, and people are just kind of sitting there, most of them in the dark, just staring up into space, just waiting. Is basically it. My dad was really no different. Walk down the hall, past the nurse's station. And there's a nurse there, the head nurse, charge nurse, I guess, giving a report. And as I pass by, she says, "Johnson, down the hall right there." So I take a few more steps, stop, look at Michelle. I was like, she's talking about Dad. And Michelle's like, "Yeah." And I was like, "Yeah, let's back up." So we back up and come back up to the nurse's desk. And she says, "He's just a train wreck." So I said, "Miss, we are the train wreck's family." And she stops, and you can tell it gets her. Like, well, now the truth of the matter is, and she tried to convince us of other bullshit, but the truth of the matter is that she was just giving a report. She later tried to convince us that she was about to call the hospital, the ambulance to come and get him. That was not true. She looks at me and she says, "Hey, go in there and see if your dad looks normal. I've not seen him since last week." So I walk in, and my father looks like he has had a stroke. He can't talk. He's laid over to one side. He can't move. He can't really do anything, but you can tell he's cognizant. So Michelle's talking to him. He can't talk, but he can blink. He can squeeze her hand a little bit, things like that. And I go back out to the nurse's station. I was like, "No, he's not okay. Let's call a fucking ambulance." And she's like, "That was my idea too." And I was like, "I'm sure it was." So I go back in, look at my dad, and my dad sees me, and he reaches his hand out so I can hold it and shake it. I'm sitting there shaking his hand, holding it. And I'm like, "Dad, we're going to get you taken care of. It's going to be okay." That was the, so the ambulance comes to get him, takes him to the hospital, and he's unresponsive by the time he gets to the hospital. So that was Friday. through Friday and Saturday, unresponsive. I go back home for a little while, take Michelle home because she had to work the next morning, nurse, come back Saturday, completely unresponsive. I'm there most of Saturday until like 1 a.m. Talked to a couple of doctors. One of the doctors is the ICU doctor. And I'm like, hey, I assume that if he pulls out of this, that he's just going to go right back into a sepsis infection because he's had them in a chain reaction. As a matter of fact, the day he got another sepsis infection, he had been on a 4-week treatment of vancomycin, strongest fucking antibiotic in the world. And the doctor's like, yeah, he probably will. I was like, okay. Then another doctor, the ER doctor, I was talking to her, and they were all very nice. And the doctor's like, you know, look, right now what's going on is that, you know, his heart from all the infections has basically just given up. And they had him on medication to keep the heartbeat down and the blood pressure up, two different types of medication. They had him on other types of medication to counter the bad effects of those medications. And that was the only thing that was keeping the man around. And I'm with him till about 1 o'clock on Saturday. So Sunday morning, I come back home, get a few hours sleep, wake up early Sunday, go in, and I'm not an idiot. I knew what was going on. So I go to visit him in the ICU unit, and this very nice nurse, thank God for her, she comes out. She's like, I'll walk you back to see your dad. And I was like, look, I said, can I talk to you for a second? And just, can we talk plainly? And she was like, yes, we can. And I was like, look, I said, I told her what the doctors had said. I said, look, my dad has been scared to death his entire life of dying. I said, he's unresponsive right now. I said, he's going to get back out of here. If he even recovers from this, he's going to get back and from there have another infection and just keep going like this. And I said, I need to know if right now is a good time for hospice and to take him off of all of this bullshit. And the nurse, again, thank God for her. The nurse looks at me and she's like, we're speaking plainly. And I'm like, yes, please. And she's like, right now would be a very good time to do this. And I looked at her and I said, thank you. What do I need to do? So they had another, the hospice nurse and doctor that came by and did the evaluation and, come to find out if they think that you're going to live more than 10 days, you have to leave the hospital. Well, they did not think that with my father. And, so they disconnected him. I was there through most of Sunday, by his side, come back home. Because I'm this idiot that it's not that I necessarily want to come home. It's that the drive, being able to get away from that, allows me to process things. So, drove home, got back up Monday morning. Drove back to Gadsden, got there. My dad, he was still breathing, still, you know, they had air coming in, but no oxygen or anything like that. So he was still breathing. Vital signs were steady, not great, but steady. And I came in and I was like, Dad, I'm here. Just want you to know I'm with you. I'm going to be with you. And it's like the man was waiting for his son. To come back. He passed away about 3 hours after I got there, is what happened. And so they had him off everything, and I'm sitting there beside him, and it became evident the last 30 minutes I looked at it, and his blood pressure was dropping, heart rate was all over the place, O2 levels were descending rapidly, and stood up. I stood by his bed the last 30 minutes. The nurse comes in, the one that had been so helpful, and she's like, she looks at me, and she's like, you know what's going on now? And I was like, yes, ma'am, I know what's happening. And she's like, well, he's due a morphine and Ativan shot in about 30 minutes, but he may not need that. And I was like, ma'am, I know that. And she's like, well, I'm going to leave you alone. And when you, I'll come back in and check every now and then. And you just take your time. And my dad passed within 30 minutes of that. And I told him, my last words to my father was that I hoped that his father was waiting for him on the other side and to please save a space for me. I think that that was the absolute best thing that I could tell the man. So after that, I was by my father's side for a little while, went out to the car, had my cry, and then proceeded to pick up the phone and call Denise, his daughter, my sister, his brother, let his stepdaughter know as well. And that's what happened. My father wanted to be cremated, so I arranged for that. And no need to go into that. That's the series of events of what happened. I just wanted people to know everything that went on before started talking about this other stuff. You know, my dad, as I said, I don't believe my dad was a good guy. I don't believe my dad was a bad guy. I believe at the end of the day, though, that his story is one where the good outweighs the bad. And I think that is what matters. In my presentations, I've spoken frequently about my father. I've said my dad was a good man, but he became the enabler. He was the man that there was me, my sister, and my mom. And my mom was the abuser physically until my sister put her through a closet, told her you're not going to touch me again anymore. Mom's heart wasn't really in the physical. It was in the emotional, the mental, the verbal negligence. My dad never stepped in to try to put a stop to it. Not one time. I mean, he would give token gestures. He would. I remember one of his favorite phrases was "Carolyn Sue" or "Carolyn, please stop, just stop, please stop," and that was one of the most common phrases we heard in the house. Please stop. You know, he would. My mom would. You know, she brings me and my sister into the bedroom one time, and she tells us, "I'm going to show you how much I love you." My dad is laying on the bed with her, and he's "Carolyn, please stop. Don't do this. Please stop. Please stop." And she used to smoke these Moore cigarettes. She took this lit cigarette. "I'm going to show you how much I love you." And she pretends to burn herself just to fuck with me and Denise. Pretended to be burning herself, and sits there writhing and screaming, and you can see the cigarettes that far away. And I kept thinking, "Well, hell, what does this mean?" My dad never stopped, never even attempted to stop that. Just the token gesture of "don't do this, don't do this." Those types of stories, the type of abuse was common. She used to bring men home in front of my father, a guy named Scott Rose. She brings him home and tells my dad, me and my sister are sitting in the living room. My dad's sitting in the living room bawling like a baby. She's telling my dad, "I'm leaving you for him." And she proceeds to pack up and walk out the door with me and Denise, Scott, and her clothes. And that lasted about, I don't know, 2 months before she decides to come home to him, and he opens his arms and takes her in. He tried one time to divorce her ass, and she climbed in through a window. Me and Dad were living in an apartment. I slept in the bed. Dad slept on the couch. And I hear some tussle late night, early morning. And my mom had climbed in through the window. I walk into the living room where my dad's sleeping and find my mom there with a knife to my father's throat. That was the one time he tried to divorce her. That was my dad. You know, he was the guy that did not protect me and Denise from the abuse that our mother subjected us to. He, if she wanted to commit a crime, he would absolutely co-sign on to that. He wouldn't hesitate. And most of the criminal stuff that went on, it was my mom's idea. She wanted to, you know, fake a car accident. That was mom's idea. She wanted to burn a car. Mom's idea. Fake a stolen car. Mom's idea. Steal a rare Winchester rifle. Mom's idea. Defraud insurance for charity fraud or disaster fraud. Mom's idea. The only two ideas my dad ever had about breaking the law. And I got to say, if you're going to do it, and my dad always said, if you're going to do it right, you know, and he never thought small. I'll give him that. So the two ideas he ever came up with the breaking the law, he gets downsized out of the U.S. military. He was a captain in the U.S. Army, helicopter pilot. Army's downsizing. So they gave him an option. Hey, yes, you can stay in the U.S. Army, but you're no longer going to be a captain. We're going to bust your ass down to a staff sergeant, but you'll still be in the military, or you can go and walk away right now. Well, my dad chose to walk away because the coal industry at that point in time was booming. So he chose to hit the door. What he didn't understand was, is that all the unions, United Mine Workers Association in UMWA, they were freaking assholes. They struck all the time over anything. And the only people who benefited were the unions. So we were, while they paid good when he was working, most of the time we were on food stamps and unemployment to try to survive. And we were going broke. My dad got this idea. He was like, well, hell, I'm a helicopter pilot. I can fly drugs back and forth across the Mexican-Texas border. Well, he knew this guy that was in the cornbread mafia named Tommy Allen Combs. Tommy Allen had served prison time, but Tommy Allen had not ratted anybody out. And my dad goes to talk to him. And I remember when I first saw Tommy, they loaded us all up. Me, mom, Denise, dad, load up in the vehicle, drive up to Tommy's house. Tommy's sitting on the porch with a slingshot, trying to shoot the chickens that are in the yard with a slingshot. And I thought that was the coolest shit in the world. I thought it was just a blast of fun. Tommy Allen, I'll tell you the story in a minute, but I found out later that Tommy Allen had had a very charitable side as well. People that lived in the hollow where he lived, Glomar Holler was what it was called. People said that he clothed all the children, made sure all the kids there in that hollow had clothes and shoes and food and stuff like that. So he had that side to him, but he had a criminal side too. Make no mistake about that. So my dad's talking to him, and you know, I guess my dad finally, after several meetings, gets the go ahead. Oh yeah, you can fly drugs back and forth. We'll do this shit. And it doesn't work out. And the reason it doesn't work out is the sheriff of Perry County one day calls up. They had a hard-on for Tommy because Tommy hadn't ratted anybody out. Sheriff calls up Tommy, and he's like, Tommy, we got a warrant for you. And Tommy's like, well, that's good. And the sheriff's like, well, why don't you come on in? And Tommy's like, well, no, why don't you come and get me? So the sheriff's like, okay, we'll come and get you. So they send a sheriff's deputy and a Kentucky State Police officer to go get Tommy. And Tommy kills one and puts the other in a wheelchair for life. A shootout ensues. And Tommy absolutely sees the Reaper that day. And because of that, my dad decided that maybe trafficking drugs back and forth for some, you know, pre-cartel thing is not a good idea. So that was the first idea. The second idea, as I said, we were going broke. I don't know if it was desperation that led him to think these things or just criminal mindset, probably a combination of both. But the second idea is he was a big fan of 60 Minutes. And he was watching this segment, you know, 20-minute segment. He was watching this segment about the drug trade in Miami. He was watching, you know, the pallets of cocaine, the tables stacked with cash and everything else. I mean, he just beat it in. No one can interrupt him at all during that segment. My mom notices it, like, what the hell is he watching? So my dad gets through watching the segment, turns around, looks at my mom. I think I need to go to Miami to be a law enforcement officer. And my mom's like, I think that's a really good idea. The plan being, he was going to become a cop, happen upon a drug deal. He was going to keep the cash. He was going to let them walk away with the drugs, and everyone was going to be nice, warm, and happy. And I kept thinking, even my young age, I kept thinking, well, they're just going to shoot your ass and keep everything. But, you know, some people you can't talk to. Anyway, they sell everything they can, round up $6,000 in cash, put everything else in a big-ass U-Haul, head south on I-75. We got to Miami as some riots were breaking out, and we were staying at a Days Inn. The Days Inn was across from this bridge, this overpass, and under the bridge were all these homeless people that were camped. And I guess my mom had never really seen that because she was scared shitless. She wouldn't let us out of the hotel room, nothing else. My dad goes to cop school like the first day, comes back. I think everything is going to be just fine. Goes to cop school the next day. We got to get our asses out of this place because what happens is the real Miami-Dade police officers had burst into the room, arrested like six people that had outstanding warrants that obviously had the exact same idea that my father did. So he was like, screw this. So they start heading north on I-75, quickly running out of money. Didn't know where they were going to go. Then they remembered that both of them at one point in their life had had spring break in Panama City, Florida. So they go to Panama City, and the only job, my mom was an LPN. She would work as a nurse long enough to see my father find his job and go to work. And then she would usually quit and go out whoring around. And that's what we called it back then. I'm not sure what they call it today, but back then it was called whoring around. And so my mom was working as an LPN at a nursing home. My father, the only job that this man could get was as a midnight clerk at a 7-Eleven in a very bad part of town. And he was making $140 a week was what he was making. And I remember that amount because that Christmas, he gave me and Denise both $70 apiece for Christmas. That's the only thing he could give us. And to this day, I still remember that. And I am still humbled by that. But that's the only thing he could give us. And I remember my dad worked his ass off. And he was always like that. He would work his ass off. He was not a very driven person. My mom often said that he had pipe dreams, and that's probably true. But the man would absolutely work. He would. He worked like a dog. So my mom finally leaves my dad, and I don't get to see my dad again. I got to see him after the hospital incident. For those who know, he rode a motorcycle. That's the only thing he had. When my mom left him, he didn't have a car. He had he started walking back and forth to work, and then finally he got the money to buy a bicycle, and then finally he got the money to buy an old used motorcycle, and that's what he rode around all the time. And he rode that motorcycle all the way up to Kentucky to see my dumbass. As I was in a cop car at the age of 15. And I got to see, I was able to say three or four words to the man. I didn't have a good conversation with him until he shows up at my sentencing for federal prison. And he stands up in front of the judge and he's like, "Your Honor, I love my son. I want to make sure he gets a good start when he gets out. He can visit with me. I mean, he can live with me when he gets out of prison." And my dad starts to visit me in prison at that point. And about the third visit in, my dad, he looks at me. He's like, "You know, I've been reading about you." And I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "Yeah, it's a lot of money you made." And I'm like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Do you think that you could teach someone how to do that?" Now, I have flipped over the years a few times on my thoughts on that. My initial thought when I started to speak about that, my initial thought was, well, he was just, you know, using me for to find out how to, you know, do tax return identity theft and steal a few hundred thousand dollars. That was my first thought. My second thought, and it took me a year or longer to come to the second conclusion of no, what was really going on is he was viewing me through the lens of my mother, that criminal activity. And he really thought that that was the only way that he could communicate with me was in that fashion. And I chose to manipulate the man into helping me escape prison in exchange for me teaching him how to do tax return identity theft. And today, I think it's a combination of both. I do. I think that my dad never, he had a very good life, but he never made the money that he wanted to make. You know, he was always worried about money. He was, he saved well. He was always worried about money. He always wanted to make more. He just wasn't willing to put in a lot of the work. I said, you know, I said he worked hard earlier, but he wasn't driven enough to try new things. He would find a job and continue to do that and just work his ass off at that. And sometimes, you know, he would advance and sometimes not. But I think that it was a combination of both during that conversation, me manipulating him, him trying to just talk to me, him wanting to know how to make money and having that greed thing too. I think it was a combination of all those things together. My dad helped me escape prison. He did. He had $4,000 cash to his name. I got him to give me that, a change of clothes, a cell phone, a driver's license. He dropped those off. I was in a federal prison, a minimum security. I had a job outside of the fence, and I just escaped. And he helped me do that. And in exchange, I taught him how to do tax return identity theft. Filing taxes on dead people is what he was doing. U.S. Marshals and the Secret Service, they went to interview my dad after my escape. And he told me the story. You know, a woman asked him, I guess the woman was in charge. Woman asked him, you know, do you know where your son is? My dad's like, no, I do not. Well, if you did know where your son was, would you tell us? My dad was, no, I would not. And then he said something about getting the hell off of his property. And that is the Kentucky way. So that was my dad. I am going to. I am going to miss the man. Someone diagnosed him, or he took one of those personality tests or whatever, and he had the, forgot what it was, the Popeye effect. He is what he is. You know, he was very fortunate that typically he did not care what anyone thought of him. And I have absolutely inherited that from him. He would tell you what he thinks and not really hold back about that. If he had something to say, he would say it. He tended to be a man of his word. He came from a very good family. Very good. And what I can say is that even though mistakes were made, he did not protect his children as he should have. I can absolutely say that in his later years, he had profound regrets on that. And he voiced those. He talked to me in depth about that. And I came to the conclusion that, you know, he came from a good family. He didn't come from an abusive environment. And my thoughts are that once he gets into that environment with my mom, the abuser, it's like a frog in water. I mean, what do you do? You've never encountered that before. Is that love? What the hell? And he's wanting to have a family. He got my mom pregnant before with me, before they got married. And I think he just, you know, had that feeling. I've had that same thing of, if I just keep it going, it'll work out. Everything will be okay. And it's not. It's not. And it wasn't. You know, my mom tried to poison him at one point. My mom kept telling him that she was going to get him to drive him to the point where he would commit suicide. She just wished him dead. this was the environment that me, my sister, my father grew up in. So he was a victim of abuse as well. He was the adult, make no mistake, but he was a victim of abuse as well. And I really think that I told him that later. I don't think he really knew how to handle it. And I completely forgave my father. My sister did not. She didn't forgive him at all. She was always angry over his failure to save me and my sister. And she was always angry about that. But, I've talked to people that, because I didn't get to spend a lot of time with my dad. My mom left. I got to spend, the formative years with my father. And he was very big about, he wanted to make sure, I don't know if he understood what he was doing, but it was like he wanted to make sure that I had a very good worldview of things. So there was no barrier. When I was six, I went to Dachau. I got to see a concentration camp. He was very big about about there not being a barrier of these things that you need to see, that you need to know about. And he talked to me not like I was a child, but that like I was an adult. If there was a film, it didn't matter if it was R-rated, no sex films, but, like dramas or suspense or, French Connection, shit like that. We would sit down and watch it, or go to the theater and watch it. There was no barriers like that. And because of him being in the military and traveling the world, I was able to get, because of my father, I was able to get a very good worldview of things and insight at a very early age. That absolutely helps to inform who I am today. And I'm very grateful for that. I'm very grateful for that. So that was my dad. And, I've talked to people that, he remarries. He remarries this woman named Patricia who died last, February of last year. And she said that he was... she always called him an ideal husband, that he couldn't ask for any better than Ray Johnson. And he was so proud of that. But he absolutely did more good than bad. I've listed a lot of the bad things the man had done. But at the same time, the man, he did all this other stuff. I can't really name it out. I can't. But I know from talking to people how he affected their lives, who he helped. For example, I taught him how to do tax return identity theft. And what did he do with the fucking money? Well, okay, he spent a little bit of it on himself. He bought an old used motorcycle, one of these big-ass Kawasaki's. I think he gave like $5,000 for that son of a bitch. The rest of the money, a family member in Hazard, Kentucky, had gotten hit with a flood. And... from what I understand, he pays to rebuild his house, not once, but at least twice out of that stolen money is what the man does. And then when I get out, he's got this money that he gives to me. He told me later on about that tax return, about the cybercrime, that was the most fun he ever had in his life, was going around pulling 20s out and figuring out how to launder them. And going like that. And I don't think it was necessarily about the amount of money that he was stealing. I think it was just the action itself gave him that excitement. And he talked about that shit for years. The two things the man talked about constantly was how he should have died in Vietnam, a.k.a. Captain Dan, and the tax return identity theft. He was convinced he didn't get to go to Vietnam. He was one of the first helicopter pilot crews that was called down. And he always told me that he really believed that his destiny, much like Captain Dan from Forrest Gump, he believed that his destiny was to die in Vietnam, and he was denied his destiny. So that was my dad. And he had a profound respect for military. He didn't suffer bullshit lightly, much like myself. A lot of my mannerisms I get from my father. certainly the outspokenness, straightforwardness, the amount of love, sometimes unconditional and toxic, I get from my father as well. You know, the I get from my father that if you're going to do it right. Make it as big as you possibly can. I get that from my dad. I get, there's so much I get from the man. And I am going to miss him. That being said, let's start closing this out because I'm rambling a little bit. So I call. I told my dad that I was going to be the bad guy and that I knew that when I told him I'd take care of him. The bad guy starts out, you know, I'm the guy that had him unplugged because no one else was going to fucking do it. He wasn't going to do it. The family members, the other ones, I didn't even ask him because my dad had given me power of attorney on all of that. The rest of them were never going to make that decision. My sister, my sister never came to visit him. She didn't ask me about him. She ends up over the past year, she called him twice. And the reason she called him twice is because I goaded her into doing it. Basically, I bitched her ass out to get her to call her fucking father. And I didn't tell him that, but he was tickled to death over those two phone calls. And he talked about them for days after she called. So she didn't care. It was the anger from the childhood, but she never called, never checked on him, never asked about him, never visited anything. His stepdaughter, as I said, she basically wrote a letter. Not basically, she did write a letter. You know, a text message. I say a letter. Text message. No, it was a text message. Text message. I showed it to my father. Sent a text message of, hey, I heard your dad's sick. Heard he's in the nursing home. Where the fuck's the money? From the house sale. And, yeah, it started even before the man died with her. Where's the money? Then, when I made the phone calls to tell everyone, I started calling everyone on Sunday to tell them that, you know, my dad died Monday on Sunday when I put him on hospice care and had everything unplugged. I called his brother, and his brother, I tell him, I was like, hey, this is happening. This is going on right now. He's not going to be around. And there's some upset. He's upset, but you know, 3 minutes into the conversation, Ray said I could have this, and this was not a sentimental item. This was a monetary item. And Ray said, you would ship it to me. And Ray said a lot more if he wasn't, you know, if he was in his right mind. Well, it turns fucking out he was not in his right mind. He had been suffering, as I said, from that hospital acquired delirium, sundowning, whatever the fuck you want to call it. So, yeah, that was then. The day I put him on hospice, my dad dies the next day. After I get through crying in the parking lot, I'm sitting there making the phone calls. Call his brother. Tell him. And I knew. Tell him. And the response is, you know, there's some stuff we got to talk about. I'll call you in a few days. And call Denise and tell her. And no response from her on that. Just she started crying and we hung up. I told her I'd let her go with that. I love my sister. I love her deeply. I then make a Facebook post about, you know, some of the shit was going on. Vultures coming out. I had a presentation in Tupelo, Mississippi. My dad died on Monday. A Tuesday, I had to drive to Tupelo. To give a presentation Wednesday. And I honestly didn't know if I would be able to do that. I honestly was concerned that I would break down on stage because, you know, for those who have seen me speak, I talk about my father at the beginning of these presentations. You know, I give some of my background, and I was really worried that I was not going to be able to make it through that presentation. And it turned out that it was one of the better presentations that I've ever given. It truly was. I talked about my dad dying some, and I was able to get through it, move on from there. After my presentation, after that, I gave a tour of the dark web, Telegram environments like that, talked about what was real, what was bullshit, why it works. Stuff like that. It was a really good, even if it was me, it was an outstanding presentation and breakout session. Well worth their money. So after that, I checked my phone and my sister has tried to call. And I called Denise back because I didn't know. I called her back. Hey, is everything okay? Yeah, everything's fine. Dad's stepdaughter tried to connect with me on Facebook. I was like, yes, she did, me too. And I promptly blocked her. And she was like, well, what do you think she wants? She probably wants. And today starts. What do you think she wants? She probably wants something. And I was like, she probably does. Probably looking for some money from the house sale, but there is no money from the house sale. And my sister gets quiet. And she was like, what do you mean there's no money? And I was like, well, my father signed me on with rights of survivor for everything the man had. There is no fucking money that I don't already own. And she was like, well, do you have receipts? And I was like, Denise, I don't need receipts because the way he set it up, once he passes away, anything the man had comes to me. Well, you may need a lawyer for that. No, I don't need a lawyer. The only receipt I need is that right of survivorship paper that he signed. And needless to say, that conversation did not go well. She starts trying to justify never visiting her father. And tells me that, you know, to him that she was just, you know, an accessory, that he never really viewed her as his daughter, things like that. And I told her, I was like, Denise, whatever you need to say, but do not expect me to co-sign off with that because your dad absolutely loved the shit out of you. No, he was not a great father. He was not. No, he was not the guy that was going to pick up the phone and call you. Anything else like that, but you know, that phone works both ways, and you were not the person that was ever going to pick up the phone and call him. But you could have asked about him. You know, you could have called him as I was telling you that he was dying. You could have called or came to visit or anything else like that. So she gets a little miffed at me, and I've not talked to her since that point. That was on the 4th of October. So, you know, few days, but I told her, as she's like, I'm going to have to get off here. And I was like, Denise, I love you and everything's going to be okay. And she's like, I love you too. And yes, I know everything will be all right. So that's what's going on, is that of course the I don't get, again, I knew I was going to be the bad guy. But I do not get how people who say that it's a loved one cannot visit, cannot ask about, cannot pick up the phone, talk to them, anything else. and they don't show up at all until someone's passing away, and then they show up with their hand out. And maybe I'm being a little harsh with that, but I don't think I really fucking care. So that's what's going on. Like I said, I knew I'd be the bad guy. I didn't realize the extent of some of it. Or maybe I did. I mean, I knew that. I knew people would come out. You know, I knew that. I knew there'd be vultures and leeches and parasites. I didn't know who they'd be. That's the best way to put it. I didn't know who they would be. I know the daughter. The stepdaughter. My dad, his wife, he looked after her. Pat one day just decides that she's going to stop eating. And that's exactly what she did. And she lasted for a long time after that. My dad by her side, he had her in the house by her side every single day taking care of her. And the woman basically chose not to eat, and that's how she passed away. So I think that's a miserable fucking way to die. I truly do. And her daughter, my dad's stepdaughter, not one time came to visit. Not one time came to visit. Once she passes away, at that point, she comes and wants, you know, the jewelry that Pat, my stepmother, had. And I had no problem with that. Yeah, that's your mom's. You should have it. But she was more worried about getting the jewelry. Oh, she came to Panama City from Jacksonville. She came to Panama City from Jacksonville to get some fucking jewelry. But she did not come from Jacksonville to Panama City to get to see her mom, as her mom was fucking dying. And then when my dad is about to hit the slab, I hear you're in a nursing home. Where's the fucking money? They ain't got nothing for you. They got a goddamn thing for you. So there is that. And then, you know, I love the shit on my sister. I do. But to come asking about receipts and stuff like that, when you didn't give a fuck enough to pick up a phone, come to visit, say hi, hello, go to hell, anything else like that. I love the shit out of her. I do. I absolutely adore my sister. But I think she was wrong on that. I understand why. I do. She was still wrong on that. I guess the lesson is for anybody who's wondering that I'm trying to teach these people who came to me with their hands out is, hey, treat people the way you'd like to be treated. You know, it's that Bible thing of turn the other cheek. What does that actually mean? Treat people the way that you would like to be treated. Forgive people. Accept people for how they are. You know, even if someone's not treating you or you think they've done you wrong, does not mean that you have to return that favor. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And I am not even a Christian. But by God, I believe that. My name is Brett Johnson. Like I said, if you've made it all the way through this, I appreciate it. I'm doing this more for me than anyone else. And because I told my dad that I would talk about him. So my name is Brett Johnson. We're going to close out this show. And I think we're going to close it out a little bit different than the way I typically close out this show. I usually close it out with stay safe, stay secure, stay vigilant. But you know what? How about do unto others as you would have them do unto you? How about treat people with respect, with love, with kindness, with understanding? Forgive people, accept people how they are. Don't think of, you know, someone should be this way. Someone should do that. do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Love thy neighbor. Love thy family. Don't just retaliate. You know, I got to get even. They're treating me bad. I got to treat them bad. No, you don't. You don't. So we're going to end up saying that, and we're going to end it because the way we end the Brett Johnson Show every single time, even today, is by saying this is the Brett Johnson Show. At the end of the day, just do the right damn thing. I'm Brett Johnson. Thank you for listening. Until next time.